Hello, and welcome to Conversations from the World of Allergy, a podcast produced by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I'm your host, Dave Stukas. I'm a board-certified allergist and immunologist and serve as the social media medical editor for the Academy. Our podcast series will use different formats to interview thought leaders from the world of allergy and immunology. This podcast is not intended to provide any individual medical advice to our listeners. We do hope that our conversations provide evidence-based information. Any questions pertaining to one's own health should always be discussed with their personal physician. The Find an Allergist search engine on the Academy website is a useful tool to locate a listing of board-certified allergists in your area. Finally, use of this audio program is subject to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Terms of Use Agreement, which you can find at www.aaaai.org. Today's edition of our Conversations from the World of Allergy podcast series is targeted towards healthcare professionals, but I think the information we'll discuss today is also going to be extremely pertinent to people who have allergic conditions and the general public as well. Today's guest is Dr. Anne Marie Singh. Dr. Singh is an associate professor of pediatrics in the Division of Allergy, Immunology, and Rheumatology in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health in Madison, Wisconsin. Throughout her career, Dr. Singh has focused on translational research with grants from the NIH and other foundations, and has also been very active within the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. Today, we'll be discussing the very basic and easy topic, of where allergies come from, the origins of allergy. So, Dr. Singh, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, and welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, this is going to be great, and you're such a great sport for taking on this topic because, as we're going to discuss, there are no easy answers, but I think it's going to be a wonderful conversation for our listeners to learn some of the nuance in it. And as I peruse your research publications, you know, I look at involvement in studies looking at aspects of childhood asthma, atopic dermatitis, food allergy, all kinds of different conditions. And at first glance, it would appear that there really isn't a single focus to your research interests, but in actuality, it looks like you're extremely focused on trying to understand what influences some people to develop allergic conditions in the first place, as well as why some improve and others don't. First off, I guess, do you feel that's an accurate assessment of what you've spent your career on? And can you tell us more about what got you interested in trying to answer some of those questions?
Yeah, I think that's a very astute way to put together sort of my research and the types of questions that I'm interested in answering. So I definitely think it's accurate. And, you know, I think, you know, the big question, the question that I get when people hear I'm a pediatric allergist, whether that's a kid's birthday party or a cocktail party or anything, it's always, you know, why is there so much more allergy than there used to be? And when I think back to my own childhood, you know, food allergy or any of these things were considered unusual. And now, as we know, they're so much more common. And so I think when I wanted to become an allergist, you know, I had an older sister that had a food allergy, and it was so rare when I was younger. And so I think that was part of what made me so interested in trying to understand, like, where did this come from and why did this happen? And then, you know, when I think about the science behind that, I mean, that's what gets me really excited. Like, it's such a wonderful opportunity to put together what we see in the clinic and the clinical questions that we have together with, you know, the science behind it. And I find that really exciting.
Well, I guess that leads to my next question, and one I love to ask our guests who really focus their careers on research about why they love that process. So can you offer some more insight as to what you enjoy most about research in general, and also what keeps you motivated to ask new questions?
Yeah, great question. So I think I'll start with the second half first. So what keeps me motivated to ask new questions? And that's always the patients in front of me in clinic. You know, when I see something in clinic that I don't understand, or, you know, we have an observation that, you know, we see over and over again, and you know, I want to understand what is behind that, or how can I be better, or how can I do better, or how can I help advance the field of allergy. That's where my questions come from. And that keeps me so motivated, is just to help be the best allergist that I can be and practice evidence-based medicine. And how can we, you know, as I mentioned, these diseases are just so much more common than they used to be. How can we prevent them? So I think prevention has really been kind of a guiding light for me in my research career. And to me, to be able to prevent something, we have to understand what causes it to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So I think if we're really interested in prevention, we have to understand what's going on. So that's kind of what keeps me motivated. And what do I enjoy about my research in general? I have to say, this may sound like corny, but it really is the intellectual pursuit of just trying to understand something that we didn't understand before. And I think that's so exciting. And, you know, there's so much freedom in research. And I think that's something that trainees and don't always appreciate. You know, when you're doing a research project as a trainee, you're working with somebody and you're working on a project that may or may not be your own personal passion, but it's definitely your PI's passion. And so, you know, part of what I love about research is sort of that ability and freedom to ask the types of questions I want to ask and dedicate my life to things that are really important to me and to the field of allergy. And I find that I derive a lot of enjoyment from that. And, you know, the other piece of it is I go home at the end of the day and I feel really good about what I did today. And I think that's really special, you know, to enjoy your job.
Yeah, I think that's very, I love hearing about the passion that our colleagues have, and you clearly have that as well. And we're all grateful that you have devoted your career to help answer some of these complex questions. You know, as you're discussing this, I was thinking, when my children, who are now 10 and 13, when they were infants and we, you know, get up in the middle of the night with them to you know, give a bottle or soothe them or whatever, I had moments of clarity. I would wake from a deep sleep, and then all of a sudden, that complex patient I saw 5 days before, the answer came to me out of nowhere. And I've always sort of been in tune with that. And lately, as time has gone on, I will personally wake up, you know, early in the morning, and it'll, you know, come to me, whether it's a research question or a presentation I'm giving. Oh, that's how I should spin it. So, do you have those aha moments yourself? Of like, what gives you the inspiration for these new ideas? Do you kind of have little things floating around, and then all of a sudden it all comes together, and you say, "That's the question I want to answer." Or is there a different process in your complex brain?
No, I completely agree. I think, you know, when I think of, you know, obviously, to me, it's a combination. So I need time to focus, you know, so I can dive deep and think and read. And I certainly need some uninterrupted time to focus. But sometimes when the answer is not right in front of you, or sometimes when the question isn't right there in front of you, it does come to me when I don't always expect it. And sometimes it's on a run, or sometimes it's sometimes after, you know, when I'm like cooling down. Sometimes it's happening when I'm doing a mindless chore, you know, folding laundry or gardening. I get a lot of, you know, ideas sometimes when I'm outside. And I think I completely agree with you that sometimes we need to kind of step away. And I'm a firm believer that even when you're not consciously thinking about a problem or something, to me, something's going on back there that I'm not really aware of. And then you absolutely get these moments of clarity or ideas or, oh, I should try this. And those are actually fun when they happen.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for sharing that. Let's move on to sort of the topic at hand here. And as we've already mentioned, you know, spoiler alert, there's going to be no easy answers here. But why don't we? Why don't we start with having you just provide some basic ground level background as to what we know about the inheritance pattern of allergic conditions in general, and then if anything, you know, any outliers stick out in your mind in regards to specific types of conditions and unique inheritance patterns, if you can touch upon that. I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah. So obviously, all of the allergic diseases, you know, whether it's asthma, food allergy, atopic dermatitis, allergic rhinitis, these are complex diseases that don't have one single cause. And so in my mind, I consider it it's a kind of a combination of the family you were born in, the genetics of that family, and then your environmental exposures. And, you know, one without the other, you know, if it's really strong, perhaps that could, you know, promote the development of allergic diseases. But in my mind, I really think that you need both. And so We know allergies tend to run in families, and you know, we have allergic families where everybody seems to have something. But then there are people who don't have a family history and they get allergies, and vice versa, where you may be from an allergic family and you're the lucky one who maybe is spared. And so, yeah, I just think, you know, there are some genes that people have just, you know, mutations in, you know, IL-13 or TSLP or, you know, epithelial barrier proteins and filaggrin, things like that, that have been shown to increase your risk of allergies for sure. But most of the times, you know, that sort of mutation alone is not enough, and there's an environmental piece to it.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you touched upon that. So it's fascinating, right? So you have to have that combination of you're predisposed to develop, but not everybody does. And just because you have the gene, so when you do these, you know, all these at-home genetic tests, have you done any of these by any chance, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah.
You know, like 23andMe or things like that. Have you experienced that and looked at the results?
No, I haven't actually. So I know I'm like the last person to the party, but I haven't.
Well, I think it just touches upon what you were saying of just because, you know, a gene is there, or, you know, you find this, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to develop that. I think that's where in this new age of all this at-home testing, we have to be really careful about, you know, what are we actually looking at and finding. And with allergies, it's more complicated than anything. But I'd like to go back to something you mentioned, because I meet families every day that have no history of allergies. Both parents, nobody in their family have allergies, yet they come to me as the allergist because their child has atopic dermatitis, food allergy, asthma, allergic rhinitis, things like that. So do we have any understanding of why that phenomenon occurs?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And to me, that's, you know, a perfect illustration of the role of the environment that could be playing in the development of allergic diseases. You know, whether it's, you know, I hesitate for a minute, but, you know, whether it's, you know, I especially see this in, you know, immigrant populations where maybe, you know, the parents don't have any allergic diseases. They come to the U.S. and either the children are born here or they weren't. And then all of a sudden they've lived here for a little while and they start developing allergic diseases. And obviously I see it in non-immigrant families as well, right, where there's no, parents don't have any allergies, but they have a child that does. And you know, we don't know all of the players. You know, there are so many studies out there that point to different aspects that may or may not be related to allergic disease development. And some of these things are things we can control and some of them aren't, you know, and some of them are host factors, you know, mode of delivery, kind of breastfeeding, season of birth. Some of them are environmental factors, exposures to maybe antibiotics or pollutants. And all of this, you know, might be fine one time, but in another kind of vulnerable or critical time window or something else is going on, then that environmental exposure might tip you over. So, I mean, I think it just points to the complex role that the environment has in shaping and the development of our immune system. It's just, you know, there's so many different factors that go into that.
Yeah, I appreciate hearing you kind of go through all the different factors. And again, for those folks listening, if you haven't gotten the hint yet, there are no easy answers.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Yeah. Can you describe the atopic march or allergic march in children and also offer some immunologic insight as to why different allergic conditions often occur in the same person?
Yeah, so that's a great question and an area that I'm very interested in. So what we know as kind of pediatric allergists, immunologists, is that, you know, the allergic diseases often can kind of go run together, meaning if you get one allergic disease, then you can be at higher risk for developing other allergic diseases. And what this kind of allergic march or atopic march refers to is there's often kind of an age or timing aspect to it, and meaning some allergic conditions we see early in life and some you may or may not see early in life, but certainly become more common as you get older. So kind of the quote-unquote prototypical atopic march is a child who develops, you know, atopic dermatitis or eczema as a young child, infant, or, you know, preschool-aged, and then they may or may not also then develop food allergy. And then as they get older, that eczema often will improve, but that child may still be at risk and they can develop allergic rhinitis and then asthma. And, you know, sometimes I think the term atopic March can be a little bit misleading in that implies that it's a strict kind of linear progression from one disease to the next, or mm-hmm. that you kind of march along on a prescribed path. And what I think we should think about is it's really more, to me, a risk of disease co-expression. And you may not express all four, you know, atopic derm, food allergy, rhinitis, then asthma, but kind of that increased risk for developing other allergic diseases, some combination as a child gets older.
Yeah, and that's something, as you mentioned, we see a lot of, right? And we just kind of watch these children evolve over time as their body changes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, I spend a lot of time on social media, and all the time I see these clickbait media headlines about the causes or cures of allergy. You mentioned antibiotics, and you know, we read the studies, the headlines that say early exposure to antibiotics are the cause of food allergy or whatever it may be. And you know, for us, one of the most common, easy to spot mistakes that we see is really just this basic confusion of correlation with causation.
Yeah.
So can you describe for us this important difference, and also how study design on either a population or cohort level often limits our ability to say that one factor caused another one to occur. So what's yeah. the deal with that? Break it down for us.
Yes, that's a complicated question, but yeah, so exactly. So, you know, correlation, you know, doesn't equal causation. And just because you see two things that kind of occur together doesn't necessarily mean one causes another. And absolutely, this is where study design becomes really important, because what we can often say, especially in a cross-sectional study or in a study that's reporting two things that are occurring at the same time, is that, you know, one phenomenon is associated with another. So, and so, you know, we have to be really clear when we think about something causing something or something being associated with something, to really look at, you know, if something causes something or another, you know, timing becomes kind of critically important. And I think you need to be able to, in my case, because I'm interested in the origins of allergic disease, follow these children kind of over time. And you really need to see how an exposure relates to incidence of the disease, you know, the development of a disease as opposed to prevalence. And so I think that's part of it. And often to truly get at causation, you know, birth cohort studies can absolutely help in that regard, because you can follow these children from birth until they get older. And then also I think animal models, this is a role for animal models, you know, to really kind of understand causation. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Did that answer the question? It's a tough one to answer. So
no, it did. It did. Can I, if I may, have a follow up? So one thing that I observe, and I want you to feel free to disagree here, but some of these more, you know, population studies or association studies, what I see is they look at a whole bunch of different factors, and then after the fact, they sort of run these different analyses. And if they find something with that magical p-value of less than 0.05, they say, aha, we have some, you know, significant correlation or whatever here. But it almost seems like that's not the best way to answer that question of what really causes, you know, one thing causes another. Do you see that as well? Or am I completely off the tracks on that one?
You know, I think this is, to me, an example of, you know, one study or one person can't do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
So like, and so, you know, I think these population-based studies and these birth cohort studies, they really, I think, can help, you know, they're more than hypothesis generating, but maybe I'll start with that, is, you know, that they can be hypothesis generating in the sense of, you know, we see something that happens, you know, or an exposure, right? So if we're talking about an exposure, so we see an exposure that then greatly increases your risk of developing an allergic disease. And so to me, that's like step one, mm-hmm. to kind of start us to unlock, like, okay, this exposure is important. could it be causing the allergy? And I think, at least in my mind and kind of my approach to this is, okay, then I need to take that exposure and try to understand what is it doing. And to me, that's where the translational and basic research can help. And so, you know, a project we have going on in my lab, you know, people talk about the microbiome, right? Mm-hmm. And like the bacteria that you have, and in my case, we're looking at the skin. So the bacteria that you have on the skin, you know, is that relating, you know, we find different bacteria may be associated with the development of atopic derm or food allergy. And so we see this association. And so the question is always like, well, is the Staph aureus causing the disease, right? And so, you know, something that we can do to help understand that is, you know, we take keratinocytes in the lab and we add Staph or Staph products to those things in the lab. And we can kind of see what the immune signals that happen and are the keratinocytes making more IL-33? Do they activate ILC2s? Do we see differences in the peripheral blood then of these children? And then you can kind of start to put the pieces together of kind of the mechanistic link of how we get from exposure to disease. And once you start putting those pieces together, I think it becomes a little easier to talk about causation beyond just association.
Boy, that was a great sort of somewhat of a deep dive into the nuance and research. Do you think, here's a loaded question, feel free to, you know, verbally slap me across the face if you don't like it. So as you say, I like how you describe hypothesis generating, and then you take it back to the lab or animal models. Do you feel that overall there is a lack of publication of negative findings? So you have that question, is Staph driving X, Y, and Z? You go to the lab and you can't reproduce that. Do you think that there's more of an inclination to publish the positive findings and not the negative ones? And if so, is that hampering our ability to truly understand all of these complex interactions? There's your loaded question.
Yeah. I think we all know there's a publication bias, right? So, it's easier to get something published when there is a positive finding, and it's difficult sometimes to get negative findings published. You know, when I'm kind of looking at some of these birth cohort work that I do, I think it's important for us to describe everything we looked at and what we found and didn't. And you know, no one ever likes looking at a ginormous table, right? Nobody likes looking at that table when there's 100 factors going down and all these p-values, many of which may or may not be significant. But, you know, I think there's a role for that, and there's a role for sharing that information, and maybe some of that's in the supplement. Do you know what I mean? But I think it needs to be there. And one study alone, that's another thing, is, you know, humans are, we're different. We're variable. We live in different places. We're exposed to different things. And, you know, so just because you find something in one study, you know, it's important to see it across different populations and not just in the U.S., but, you know, across the world. So, and I think that just points to the variability and the complex nature of the gene by environment kind of interaction.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And then one last follow-up to that. Can you speak to how it's important to understand limitations of studies, and whether it's the methodology or the findings, and because you touched upon this a couple of times, and I think it's so important. One study does not make the end all be all for anything. So what do we need to understand about limitations?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think understanding limitations is crucial as we try to interpret, right, all of the studies and the data that's out there. And I think, you know, especially when we're looking at these clinical studies, observational studies, you know, it's always important to look at the patient population. So who's enrolled in the study? What were the criteria to get into that study? You know, was it high risk or population-based? What is the makeup of the study population in the cohort? And does it represent the patient that's in front of me, or, you know, the people that are around me? So that's part of it. And then there's a methodology piece, like how was the data and information collected? And is that, you know, is there a reporting bias there, or is the way they made a diagnosis the way you would make a diagnosis, or does that apply into your situation? So, you know, I think without making it overly complicated, I mean, really, you know, every step of the along the way, from who's in, how the study was designed, who was enrolled in the study, how did they gather the information, how did they analyze the information, all of that to me goes into the interpretation and understanding limitations and generalizability of findings.
Yeah, this is great. I'm really enjoying this conversation. It's interesting to me how we've sort of segued into just understanding the fundamentals of research before we even get into, but it's important,
sorry,
right?
About a topic that, yeah.
Like, no, it's, I led you there. So this is great. Yeah. But yeah, it goes back to just, there's no easy answers. And well, I'd like to transition to something called the hygiene hypothesis, if we can, because I've been hearing about this for more than 20 years, probably. Can you describe this for us? And then also let us know, like, does it still hold up after all this time?
Yeah. So, you know, the original hygiene hypothesis was proposed in like the late 80s. Like, I think it was 1989, I think, by Strahan. And basically, the original hygiene hypothesis was perhaps we were, quote unquote, too clean. And, you know, not exposing our young children to, you know, enough infections or bacteria or whatever, and that this was kind of related to the increase or this rise in allergic diseases. And you know, I think the hygiene hypothesis has certainly evolved over time, like all good science and all hypotheses should. As we get more data, they should evolve. And I think now, when I think about it, it's really, to me, what we have learned, you know, from the beginning of the hygiene hypothesis, is that early life really is a critical time window for the development of the immune system. And whether your immune system, you know, maybe will continue its propensity to be Th2 biased, or maybe balance out, or whatever, you know, IL-17 or Th1 or whatever. And I think the early life is really important, and the exposures that we have in early life can really help shape kind of the development of the immune system. And so, you know, do I think we're too clean, quote unquote? Like, no, I don't think that's it. But I think, you know, there are certain exposures that happen in early life that can shape the development of the immune system. And there's even some data to think about some things that are the opposite of the hygiene hypothesis, which is sometimes high dose allergen exposure early in life can prevent the development of allergic disease. So we know from the LEAP study that early introduction of peanut can help prevent peanut allergy. We know from studies from Eureka, or the studies of, you know, urban environments in children, that high allergen load in an urban environment where they don't have a lot of access to playgrounds and parks and green space, but that high allergen exposure to cockroach and mice can prevent actually allergic disease, which is sort of the opposite of what was hypothesized in that study. We know farming environments can help, you know, exposure to the barn and things in early life can also prevent allergic disease. So, I mean, I think it tells us what the exposure is, and the timing is really important. On the other hand, early exposure to rhinovirus and RSV, severe, you know, infection can promote asthma. So, you know, I just think there's so much that's out there, and the exposure matters, the timing matters. And then the other key piece of this is, you know, to truly prevent, right? It has to be before something has happened. So, you know, for example, like there are studies that suggest, you know, dog exposure could prevent you from developing allergies. If that's the case, I mean, for that to be true, it needs to happen like really before you're allergic. So that's, you know, once you're allergic, don't get a dog to try to fix something. Do you know what I mean? So, and so that's, again, pointing to this timing aspect too. But that was a long answer to your question, but I think it's a complicated question that has evolved over time as we've gotten more data.
You know, Dr. Singh, we invite you on. You have not given me one straightforward answer yet. This is unbelievable.
Yes. Well, now you're understanding the nuanced nature of this topic.
Is it normal for to have a headache after this conversation?
I know. I hope not. Then I'm not doing a good job of
No.
explaining it. So.
No, really, this is great. Let's go back to the dog example, because I see the headlines. The headlines say dogs prevent allergies. Of course, there's more nuance to that. But should every family have a cat or a dog in their home to prevent their child from developing allergies?
So, obviously no, right? So I feel, there are so many things that go into having a pet. What is true is, across multiple studies, early life exposure, and I think the signal is stronger for dogs than it is for cats, but that early exposure, from birth, and this is what I mean by early. So, having a dog from birth has been shown to protect against the development of allergies or asthma. This kind of gets into what is it about having a pet or a dog that could be do it that could be doing it. And it could be exposure to allergen or endotoxin. It could be people who have dogs walk outside more and they have more vitamin D. Like, I'm not sure. Like, there are so many different things that it could be. But obviously, if you have a family member that's already allergic to dog, it's not whether that's a parent or an older sibling or something, like, then sometimes having the dog will be more harmful for that family than it will do good. And obviously, it's responsibility and a complex lifestyle choice. So, I don't know. That's kind of what I think when families ask me about a dog, I kind of tell them all of that. So,
Yeah, so it's not like the golden ticket to prevent it.
correct.
I can't remember who gave this presentation. It was years ago, and they had this wonderful slide where they talk about, you mentioned endotoxin, of what is it about having a dog in the home from birth? Is it exposure to the dander that typically causes allergy symptoms, or is it the fact, and they had a picture of a dog drinking out of the toilet and then licking the baby's face?
Right.
Is it more something along those lines? But yeah, we don't know.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Speaking of the microbiome, so it's been a really hot topic for the last several years, and you expressed an interest in studying this as well. At this point, have we learned enough about this in relation to allergic conditions to suggest that either everybody have their microbiome tested, or that we can prescribe specific treatments based upon the results, or is this really still in its infancy stage?
Yeah, I think both parts of that question could be true. So, in general, I think it's still in its infancy stage. And I think just like everything in medicine, I think it's complex. So, we find some signals, and to me, one of the clearest examples is, Staph aureus and AD. So, we know that there's this bacteria that's related to, or with related to atopic dermatitis, and we know that, when you get blooms of Staph aureus, that could be associated with flares of your atopic dermatitis and things like that. But even then, not every, I think it's complex that not every strain of Staph aureus is equal. And, some might be more pathogenic than others. And we have some data in my lab to suggest that. And, in the same way, like Staph epi is considered to be protective, but not every strain of Staph epi is the same. And so I think in some respects, we're still in the infancy and we're still learning. On the other side, there are some microbiome-based therapies that are in clinical trials. So there's certainly nothing FDA approved at this point, but there is, a topical therapy that the ADRN and with Rich Gallo that they're looking at that, has kind of basically dead strains of a staph that start to be that's a staph species that is felt to be protective. And so there's a clinical trial of, a skin kind of cream. If we apply this to the skin, can that help with the disease? And then there's an inhaled therapy that is being given through a nebulizer to see if back and, you know, which is also dead bacteria, to see if that can prevent asthma. So, you know, these therapies are out there. They're in clinical trials. So I think both parts of the answer is true. We have a lot to learn, but there are some treatments that are getting investigated.
Oh, fascinating. And yeah, I think that this is going to just truly blossom in the next decade or so. And hopefully it's going to lead us in some, you know, very concrete directions for a non-concrete sort of topic. You just mentioned atopic dermatitis, and I noted that you are the lead author on an Academy Workgroup report titled Atopic Dermatitis and Food Allergy, Best Practices and Knowledge Gaps, a work group report from the Academy Allergic Skin Diseases Committee and Leadership Institute Project. In this document, there's a lot of discussion regarding something called the dual exposure hypothesis. And I think that that fits in very well with this conversation. Can you explain what the dual exposure hypothesis is and how it pertains to atopic dermatitis?
Yeah, so great question. And the dual exposure hypothesis was first proposed by Gideon Lack, and basically what, you know, to try to think about, you know, the atopic march, or why is it that kids with atopic dermatitis are susceptible to food allergy or at higher risk for developing food allergy. And what the dual exposure hypothesis kind of hypothesis it purports is that, you know, oral exposure to a food allergen, you know, such as peanut, can help prevent allergic disease, but exposure to that same allergen through inflamed skin, so cutaneous exposure, particularly on inflamed skin, can promote the development of food allergy. And so kind of the dual exposure is, you know, that this dual exposure of, you know, through inflamed skin, but also through the gut, can help potentially prevent the development of allergic disease, where if you have single exposure just through the skin, then that can promote the development of food allergy. And so that is kind of, you know, a short way to kind of explain the dual exposure hypothesis. Again, exposure through cutaneous inflamed skin alone can kind of promote the development of food allergy and, you know, kind of Th2 responses, where oral exposure can help prevent that and kind of tilt the immune system more towards regulatory T cells and Th1 sort of responses. So, and so it's really important when we start thinking about, you know, food allergy and atopic dermatitis, where, you know, eating a varied diet and, you know, early exposure to a, particularly peanut, which is what has shown the dual exposure hypothesis to likely be true, that early exposure to peanut can help prevent the development of peanut allergy.
Mm. So eating is good, rubbing on the skin bad from an allergy standpoint.
Correct. That would be a nice simplified version of that.
It's quite common. I actually see pediatricians in my area telling families to rub food on their child's skin before letting them eat it, because that way they'll know if they're actually allergic to it or not, which just horrifies me. Do you think that that's good advice, or is that something you would advise against?
I would certainly advise against, similar to you, because, you know, we know that exposure to the skin could be sensitizing and make it worse. And also, you know, foods can sometimes irritate the skin, and just because it irritates your skin a little doesn't necessarily mean you're allergic to it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like I always, you know, my whole goal always, I always tell this to all my families, like my goal is always to make that list of foods you're avoiding as short as possible. You know, I'm constantly trying to remove food allergy. I'm not trying to give people food allergy. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, we are kindred spirits. I do everything I possibly can to get food in the diet, not take it out. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, thus far in the conversation, you've discussed genetic predisposition, the influence of early life exposures on the development of allergies. Other than what you mentioned in regards to early introduction of peanuts and keeping it in the diet, are we at a point where we can, where we should be confidently recommending strategies focused on primary prevention of specific allergic conditions? And if so, what are those things that we should be recommending?
Yeah. So to me, primary prevention is like the holy grail, right? Like, so is there something that we can do that can prevent these allergic conditions from happening to begin with? And I really think we're just in the beginning and in the infancy of primary prevention. And so, you know, with regards to food allergy, you know, early introduction of peanut and, you know, now we recommend early introduction of egg. I think having a varied diet can also just be helpful, like exposing kids to different types of foods with regards to food allergy. You know, primary prevention for other allergic diseases is that one's a little harder, you know. So there was some early data that suggested that perhaps, you know, proactive use of an emollient can help prevent AD, but now, you know, through the beef trial and others, like maybe not, you know, is that helping everything? We've tried primary prevention of asthma with the PEAK trial, you know, giving, you know, inhaled steroid for at-risk children. And, you know, it did help control symptoms, but it did not alter the natural history. So, you know, I think it's something we're all working towards, but I'm not really sure if there's anything we can do, you know, at this point besides early introduction and really just trying to, you know, expose children to a variety of things and, you know, limit antibiotic use, you know, kind of all the things that just to promote health in general.
Mm-hmm. I haven't heard you mention breastfeeding yet. What do we know about breastfeeding and protection of development of allergies?
Yeah, so that was sort of intentional. I haven't said much about breastfeeding because I think it's really complex. There are certainly studies that suggest breastfeeding can help prevent the development of atopic derm and food allergy, but there are also studies that suggest that it's not protective as well. And so I think this kind of gets to what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, the population matters, is, you know, who is it that's in the study and what is the duration of breastfeeding? And we know breastfeeding has so many other really important benefits for both the mother and the child that whatever difference it may be having on allergic disease development probably isn't what we should be focusing on, and we should be focusing on all the other health benefits to breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great explanation of just, you know, there are many reasons to do it, but for some reason, you know, some women can't do it. They're unsuccessful, and we also don't want them to feel guilty if they're unable to do that because they think that that's going to cause their child to develop allergies or anything like that.
Agreed. Absolutely, yeah. Agreed.
You know, similar to yourself, I really love learning about and helping families better understand food allergies. And I believe that we're on the cusp of better understanding regarding phenotypes and endotypes, just like we were with asthma 10, 15 years ago, and truly individualizing approaches to diagnosis and management. So I like to ask our guests to make predictions, and I won't hold you accountable. Don't worry about that. But where do you predict that we'll be as a field regarding food allergy treatment, say, 10 years from now?
Yeah. So I think right now, just as you say, this is a really exciting time when we think about how much we're learning and where the field of food allergy is moving. My hope 10 years from now is we'll understand a lot more about basically the role nutrition has in food allergy. So, you know, kind of what foods, timing of foods, amount of foods, other nutritional aspects, you know, varied diet, you know, vitamin D, those sorts of things that could all be playing a role in helping food allergy, you know, the role of fresh fruits and vegetables, perhaps, as opposed to, you know, processed foods, things like that. I think that will all be important. I also think we will have some treatments regarding food allergy. You know, right now we have our first FDA-approved therapy for food allergy, for peanut allergy, the oral immunotherapy for peanut. And I expect to see, you know, much more oral immunotherapy, but also other forms of therapy, such as, you know, perhaps epicutaneous. I think we're going to see biologics as well that could be used for food allergy, whether that's, you know, a cytokine blocker or anti-IgE. I think it's really, really exciting. And I think as we understand, as you were saying, phenotypes of endotypes, like kind of bringing it back to your atopic March, like I think we'll start to understand the different phenotypes and endotypes of atopic derm and who truly is at risk for food allergy and asthma, and targeted interventions for those children. I would love to see that, and I think it's coming.
Yeah, I sure hope so. I would love to see some intersection of artificial intelligence, if we can take advantage of that and come up with some predictive modeling, as you mentioned, of like who's really at risk to develop this and can we intervene earlier. But yeah, we'll see what the future holds, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you able to tell us about some of your current research and what questions you're trying to answer at this point? And it's completely understandable if you're not able to disclose that for any reason?
Yeah, no. So as I'm sure you could glean from this conversation, like I'm really interested in, you know, the development of the immune system and how either host factors or environmental factors kind of shape immune development and you know, including some of the mechanisms of how that happens. So kind of the big picture of my research, you know, is I kind of think about it and, you know, different steps along that pathway. So the first is, you know, of course, clinical. You know, who is it that's developing allergic diseases? And, you know, what have they been exposed to that is, you know, perhaps associated with disease expression, and then understanding kind of the phenotypes and endotypes therein. And then the second piece is, you know, what are the mechanisms and how is that happening? So I kind of mentioned some of the studies we're working on where we're identifying different strains of, you know, Staph aureus and Staph epi. Actually, we're looking at all the staphylococcal strains that we find on the skin and seeing which ones are associated with who develops food allergy, and then taking those strains into the lab, as I mentioned, and trying to understand kind of what's happening at the epithelial barrier. And, you know, we're looking also in the nose, you know, for asthma. We're looking on the skin for atopic derm. And then kind of the third piece of this is, all right, now you have a disease, you know, whether that's, you know, food allergy or AD, how do I now take the best care of you that I can? And how do I make that list you're avoiding as short as possible? Mm-hmm. And how do I identify who should have a food challenge and who shouldn't? So those are kind of the some of the work that is going on, but it's really all focused in on, I would say the primary focus is really understanding what's happening early in life, really with this key to trying to get at prevention, as you mentioned. And when we fail, I should say, meaning like when somebody gets an allergic disease, of course, I want to take the best care of that child as I can. So I want to make sure the things that I'm doing are evidence-based and help removing barriers for the family. So, yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. Dr. Singh, this has been such a great conversation. I really appreciate you being brave enough to discuss some of these broad issues for a topic of which we don't have, you know, any single or easy answer. Did we miss anything major in your mind that you'd like to discuss?
No, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun to talk to you. And I know there really isn't just a clear cut answer, do this and it will prevent why, and I wish we're there, but we're working on it.
I like that, we're working on it. Well, yeah. If I may ask one last question, if you had one message that you could send to every patient or every parent of a child with allergies regarding why this happened to them or their child, what would that message be?
Yeah, so this question comes up in clinic all the time, and to me, the most important message that I try to give to my families is that, you know, it's not one thing that they did or they didn't do. And so I just try to remove that from the equation altogether. It's not because you breastfed or because you didn't breastfeed. It's not because you were eating peanuts when you're pregnant or because you are not eating peanuts when you're pregnant. It's just not one thing that you did. And these, as we've talked about over the last hour, is these diseases are really complex, and it's never one thing. It's a combination of a lot of different factors. And so kind of the one message I always try to tell my patients is, you know, it's nothing that you did or didn't do. And now the corollary to that is my job is to help you live your best life, you know, with this diagnosis. And I don't want you to feel like you just have to live with asthma or AD or food allergy. I really want to help those families thrive and do everything they want to do. Play on the sports team if they have asthma. Go travel if they have food allergy. Like, my job is to help you understand, you know, what you can do to keep yourself safe but not make yourself crazy, and kind of really live your best life.
Oh, what a great positive message. Thank you very much. And, you know, thank you again for being with us today. This was great. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I really enjoyed it.
Yes, as did I. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Please visit www.aaai.org for show notes and any pertinent links from today's conversation. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so you can receive new episodes in the future. Thank you again for listening.